The session, as you'll see in the program, is actually a panel session to occur on the stage here beside me. And I'd like to introduce you to the host of this afternoon's panel, and that is Vicky Marchant. Vicky is the manager of the Teaching and Learning Initiatives team at TAFE New South Wales Illawarra Institute. Vicky has over 20 years' experience in TAFE New South Wales, in which time she has challenged traditional approaches to vocational education and training from the outset and implemented flexible learning from very early in her career. She's been developing and teaching online courses since 1999, including working with an international team to design and then facilitate a graduate certificate course called Facilitate and Manage E-Learning, or FAME, which was using e-learning and constructivist approach. In 2001, Vicky became a flexible learning leader of the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. She has continued to embrace social networking, web collaboration and publishing tools, including now moving in to look at the new POV technologies. Vicky and her team at Illawarra Institute are working with these new POV technologies and other media technologies to support learning and assessment in vocational education and training. Ladies and gentlemen, our host for the panel this afternoon, Vicky Marchant.
Well, it's not science fiction anymore. And this is the message. Take these off. This is the world we live in now. I'm a TAFE teacher. My head's not big enough for this. So I've moved from science fiction to vocational education and training. So point of view has moved from the older traditional application in surveillance, security, policing, etc., into the realm of education and our learning environment. Sorry, I've lost my glasses. As a TAFE teacher and a computer user, I've also gone blind in the last 20 years. Okay, so we've moved into the learning environment where teachers and learners are donning camera glasses and helmet-mounted video and headband cam, as we can see Matt down the back there. And we're going to explore a bit in this panel discussion about why that's happening, what's happening with it, where it's taking us, and what the issues and barriers are and so on about POV, and how we can use it to enhance learning. I'm going to have to take this off. Okay. Okay. So I'd like to now introduce you to our esteemed panel members. And firstly, I'd like to introduce Andrew Park from CV Seek. Andrew, I thought you guys would all be sitting up here by now, but... Andrew Park, for those who don't know, is the CEO of CV Seek, a new and innovative e-portfolio provider. An innovator in internet technology in the Illawarra, Andrew was the first to open an internet cafe in 1996 on the south coast of New South Wales, continuing into a core focus on effective blended delivery strategies. Andrew moved into the vet sector in 1999. Andrew has participated in e-learning projects for Access Community Groups, TAFE New South Wales, Wesley Institute, and most recently the J2S Group. And I think we've got some other people from there as well here today. Andrew is the founder of M-Training, a provider of e-learning and resource solutions to the vet sector. Andrew continues to be on the leading edge for deploying e-learning solutions. So welcome, Andrew. Our next panel member is Robin Jay from the University of New South Wales, formerly, we like to acknowledge, of TAFE New South Wales as well, and the IC Vet team. Robin Jay has worked in all sectors and levels of education and has supported the uptake of e-learning in vet and higher education for the past 10 years. With a background in adult literacy and special education, she is passionate about providing opportunities and a voice to learners, traditionally excluded from the traditional written text-based educational modes. Robin is currently the Learning and Teaching Architect for the L&T, Learning and Teaching IT Portfolio, at the University of New South Wales. Acting as a conduit between IT and the UNSW faculties and staff to support the development of an integrated enterprise-level suite of educational technologies. Amongst other work, Robin is currently rolling out UNSW WordPress MU, Wikispaces and MediaWiki as part of a six-month evaluation pilot of blog and wiki platforms. So welcome, Robin. Our next panel member is Tony Twiss, who we've heard from this morning, our international speaker from Hamilton, New Zealand. And Tony is the Director of E-Learning and ICT Professional Development Facilitator at a number of secondary schools. She lectures in media studies part-time at the University of Waikato. I'm abbreviating here because I think we all heard Tony's bio this morning. That's okay. She's recently undertaken a project with mobile phones sponsored by Vodafone in secondary schools in New Zealand, looking at the use of SMS calls data on 3G mobile phones. She also explored the potential for the mobile phones in the classroom, the impact on 24/7 access to information on education and future and skills for students. So welcome, Tony. Also joining us is Katina Michael. You hear? Oh, here she comes. She's also from the University of Wollongong and the University of Technology, Sydney. She's a senior member of the IEEE 2004. Katina is on the IEEE Technology and Society magazine editorial board and is the technical editor of the Journal of Theoretical and Applied Electronic Commerce Research. Say that quickly. Her research interests are in the areas of automatic identification, location-based services, emerging mobile technologies, national security, and their respective socio-ethical implications. Katina is currently a senior lecturer in the School of Information Systems and Technology, Faculty of Informatics, University of Wollongong, Australia. She teaches e-business, strategy, innovation, communication security issues, the social impact of technology, and is the research director of the IP location-based services program in the Centre for Business Services Science. Good. Thank you. Our next guest is Associate Professor Tony Harrington, also from the University of Wollongong. We've heard from Tony this morning. Tony is the Associate Professor of Adult Education and IT in Education at the University of Wollongong, where he teaches and supervises postgraduate students studying in the Masters and PhD programs. Tony's research focuses around using emerging technologies to support professional learning. Recently, Tony has been involved in the ALTC-funded project investigating the use of mobile technologies to support the professional learning of pre-service teachers. Welcome, Tony. And our next guest is Matt Fitzharding, and I hope he's going to come up and wear his headband cam on the stage for us.
Oh, no.
Cool. Now, Matt is going to introduce himself on stage, so I'm going to pass the first question to him, and seeing as how he's wearing some of the POV equipment, let's ask him about what sorts of things in terms of equipment do we need to do POV? What are some of the practicalities, things that we need to get started doing POV? So over to you, Matt. Introduce yourself and then tell us about...
Thank you very much. My name's Matt Fitzharding. I'm part owner of a company called Launch Helmet Cams. We're a
Thank you very much. We're an online retailer and distributor of helmet camera and wearable video technologies. So I guess that was why I was invited here. The technology is moving along very rapidly now. We've seen considerable change in the last few years, and it's only going to start moving faster as the technology becomes more accepted and people are more aware of POV technology. A lot of the advancements that we're just starting to see now are more to do with the transmission of data, especially live transmission of data. So whereas at the moment we're quite restricted in how we deal with this information, in that we record it and then we do it in a post-edit and then work with the information afterwards. What we're starting to see now is companies investing a lot of money in being able to transmit this data live over the internet, and especially over 3G and satellite networks. Obviously, as the codecs improve and the compression improves of the information, and as the pipe stream gets bigger and we can push more data through it, the ability to have high-quality, smooth video is becoming a reality. And the applications for that are really huge. We're just starting to see a lot of emergency response groups wanting to have access to this technology so that they can send someone out into the field, and rather than have to have a heap of specialists out in the field, they can have one person out there collecting the data and being told to move around, go here, look at this, open this valve, do that, or whatever it is. Even in things like medical emergency response, being able to have a specialist back at the hospital that can see what the doctors or whatever are doing on site, and being able to give them specialist advice real time is where this is all starting to head. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Well,
thanks for that, Matt. I'd now like to introduce our final panel member, and that will be Alison Miller, who was one of our keynote speakers this morning. And Alison is the business manager for the ePortfolio Managing Learner Information Business Activity for the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. Alison has worked as the South Australian e-learning innovations coordinator and the project manager for the Inclusive e-learning youth project, also for the Australian Flexible Learning Framework, as well as the e-learning development coordinator for TAFE South Australia. She has 7 years' experience as a lecturer facilitator with TAFE SA in areas of business, finance, administration and small business management. Welcome. Okay, so Matt's given us a bit of an idea about where the technology's heading. If I'm a teacher and I want to get started using POV, where am I going to start and who am I going to ask? Andrew.
Oh, thank you.
He didn't pay me enough, so I'm going
Okay. Thank you for that question. Pretty intimidating being up here with a lot of smart people. I would say for teachers getting involved in it would be to, one, seek out a possible champion, someone that's already been involved, not necessarily in POV technology, you know, outright, but e-learning, some sort of blended delivery, and been involved in looking at, you know, the whole adaptive technology solutions, going out, seeking their advice and their experience and their knowledge, what mistakes they've made, and then how to try and move forward. Maybe in some institutes, go around IT. Right. I'm not sure what else, and just go out, have a look at all the fantastic resources on the place, like the Flexible Learning Framework sites, you know, and all those different networks, and then just have a go at it. And most importantly, and I think it's been said a few times this morning, hand the devices over to the users. You know, for me, the first thing I do when I get the technology at work, I go home and I take them to my kids, leave them with the kids for the weekend. And then we do a little bit of an analysis of a weekend and have a look at the resources and go, aha. So for me to be, have a look at the experience from your colleagues and then hand them over to the users.
Very good. So do you think POV as a technology is actually going to start to drive some changes in thinking and pedagogy around learner-centred approaches to delivery. And maybe Tony might talk a little bit about this, because that was kind of part of the topic of his presentation this morning. I only caught the very tail end of it, but I got the impression that there was that handed over into the hands of the learner in terms of the technology and how that can change the way you deliver.
Somebody mentioned Ken, is it on? Yeah, somebody mentioned Ken Robinson this morning, who managed to see him on the 7:30 report. If you didn't see it, have a look at his YouTube video. It is absolutely brilliant. And, you know, he talks about getting kids involved in creative activities, letting the students use them. He didn't talk about technology at all, but if you would put words in his mouth, it'd be about letting the kids have a go using the technology, whatever that technology might be, getting the students to use the technology. But don't hear it from me. Go and look at the YouTube video. Back to the getting teachers to actually use it, I think I'd like to make a comment, and it relates to what I talked about this morning, and that's the professional learning aspect is essential, and I think you've got to do it in collaboration with your peers. You've got to actually get a group together, put out some feelers, who's interested in playing around with this technology. Let's get together and talk about it. We don't need an expert to come in and tell us how to use it, because we are the experts in terms of teaching and learning. We know what works in our classrooms and what doesn't. Let's look at this technology. What can it do better than what we currently use, and how can we be a bit more innovative and get enthusiastic about it? And that action learning process is a very powerful process, because it gets people empowered. They get keen, enthusiastic, and they actually want to talk and tell others and share their experiences.
Good, thanks, Tony. Great. I think also coming out of a lot of the presentations this morning was the convergence of this kind of video technology and social networking and personal publishing and those sorts of things that also developed outside of the educational realm that we've kind of adopted. And I think a few people mentioned about, you know, old technologies that have been out there, and we're bringing them into education and using them in innovative new ways that other people never really expected. I think Michael talked about Twitter, for example, and we're seeing lots of examples where we're using YouTube in education where it wasn't, you know, that wasn't the purpose of it. But in terms of convergences of technology and where POVs kind of come into the picture, is that an influence? And maybe, you know, Tony, you could talk about this in terms of your experiences of using those technologies that weren't originally developed for education, mobile phones, for example.
I think that, as I sit up here in frantically mull, I think that new technology for me allows us to do a lot of the stuff that we have talked about for a long, long time and said, well, what if we could do authentic learning or give our students authentic learning tasks. And I think that point of view has got a huge role to play in that. So technology makes, my favourite sort of analogy for explaining it is the whole idea of the flat classroom and the ability to bring community from outside of the classroom into the classroom, but then also to get our students out of the classroom without actually leaving the classroom. So get them sharing their ideas, get them actually creating content or learning about something for a purpose and giving them an authentic reason to share that learning. So I think that when we start looking at the range of platforms that we've got, so we can combine POV with what we've already heard with YouTube, with live streaming it. It's not just the technology on its own, it's when you start combining it with other technologies and actually using it for a greater purpose, not just stopping. And I think that's when you go into schools and you start to use new technology with teachers, often they stop at the end product, which is, here I've produced something with the technology, and the challenge is to take it that much further and engage with it and discuss with it and build on it and mash it up if that's the case.
Yeah, that's a really good point there, Tony, about using some of the other technologies to actually complete that learning cycle. And I think we've also talked about the video being a product versus that being part of a learning process for the learners. And we've had some discussion about some of the other aspects of that, and maybe Alison might talk about that in terms of how that then flows into the assessment process for students, and when we're actually using POV and technologies like that for assessment, you know, where's that going to take us?
My automatic thing is around that the policy and or the systems that prevent us to do the really great stuff that we can do. In terms of often in assessment, we always think it's the end thing, it's the output, and it's not. Assessment's actually a three-stage process. And when you bring people to an educator, the first thing the educator will want to do is do a bit of a diagnostic assessment of this person. What do they already know? What am I going to build on? You also have a continuous assessment. You have what they call formative assessment, that as you work with that person, you start to make judgments about whether they're getting this or not getting this sort of thing. And then we have the summative assessment, which is often what we're always focusing on and thinking about when we talk about assessment. And I think there needs to be a major shift away from the summative assessment, the end product, and more of a shift onto the process, because that's where that learning's happening. It's not just about the end product.
Yeah, so assessment's more about learning, not just evidence at the end that someone can do something.
And it's a lot harder to assess that process. It's a lot harder to record that process. And I suppose that's potentially where your POVs and your digital media allows you to actually record it. Whereas, you know, in a summative assessment, it's usually quite obvious whether or not the person's done it or not. But the learning process, actually measuring and recording the whole learning process, which is obviously where the e-portfolio would fit in. You knew I was going to fit that in, didn't you, Mike?
Yes, absolutely. And that brings me to another question about if the students are recording bits along the way, there's lots of bits, all the videos end up being, you know, a huge amount in terms of file sizes or file volumes, where are we going to put all of this stuff? How long do we need to keep it if it's an assessment evidence thing? And maybe Robin might be able to address this, because I know that she kind of brought this up in our previous discussions and wiki collaboration on this panel. That dilemma, I suppose, about where do they go, how long do we keep it, how does it relate to you know, lifelong learning even, and that sort of thing. So, Robin.
Well, Vicky, I brought it up because I knew it would be an issue, not because it's an issue for me. So.
No, but have you got any thoughts on it? Maybe we'll throw
look,
it
I think,
open
I think
to
part
everyone.
Of the beauty of this technology is its transience. And I think that there are going to be tensions around that kind of impermanency of it and the kind of in the moment of it, which, you know, I'm sure you can relate to. In a way, I think, you know, used in its best way, it's almost like a comment in Twitter, you know. 2 weeks later, it's gone. But it doesn't really matter because it's kind of, it's happened and you've captured it and reflected on it and moved on. But I think the tension lies where that butts up against particularly our vet system, probably not quite so much in higher ed, but in our vet system, where we feel a need to, where we have to record and store evidence and data and, you know, assessment stuff for 7 years. Yeah. Now, I raised this in another discussion that we had, and I think it might have been Lee's session at Sydney Institute that we had recently. And Jeff's comment was, well, you don't keep it, you just make notes about it and you store that. Well, to me, that kind of comes down to almost to a tick and flick kind of arrangement again. I mean, sure, yeah, you can write notes, but can you imagine, you know, somebody capturing their own personal impression of something out in the field and then an assessor translating that into notes that go on to file for 7 years? It's just a very strange kind of circumstance, I think, and I'm not quite sure how those of you who do need to keep assessment data for audits and stuff, how you're going to manage that. But just on another note, I think the content that's produced belongs to, well, who does it belong to? I think we need to discuss that a little. And
yeah, well,
who manages it? You know, what where does it go and who manages it? A big issue.
So is it up to the organisation, the RTO, to keep those files, that evidence, or is it up to the student to keep them for as long as they want to?
Well, I can't speak.
And do we need to actually keep the product of a student's learning and assessment within our organisation?
At UNSW, the policy is that anything that is accessible needs a copy needs to be kept of, you know, by the uni, but it essentially belongs to the student. The other great, we're very lucky that we work under Creative Commons, so we don't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
That's another good point. I suppose we haven't quite made it to the Creative Commons decision in terms of formal policy. I think some of us operate in that environment, but it's not really within our policy environment yet. I think Alison.
And it's along the lines of the regulatory stuff rather than the POV stuff, but there's a move towards having a national regulation system which is first going to be trialled out designed by the university sector, and then the vet sector is going to be brought into it in about 2012. So it will be interesting to see whether or not the university's approach to recording assessment will change under that.
Thanks, Alison. One of the other questions that has come up in workshops and discussion and just through the networking and so on, and also I don't know if many of you listened to the podcast that Robin and Alex and Jeff did yesterday and Stefan uploaded to his Talking VTE blog. And Jeff made an interesting comment about the progress of POV starting at the kind of gimmick stage, and I suppose when you look at his safety glasses with the big black camera sitting right there as at your third eye, hey? It kind of looks a bit gimmicky, and then we sort of then accepted that this was a good technology, and he also made the comment that actually making the camera visible made it more acceptable in an educational environment, and people didn't feel like they were being spied on surreptitiously, you know, like the ubervalence kind of concept. And that from that sort of initial gimmicky stage, we moved on to kind of more serious application of it, but at that point we're sort of not yet there with the quality of the videos and the material that we're producing, but the message and the content is still fairly clear, and that we're going to move towards better quality with the equipment that we have, and that's maybe going to impact on the uptake of it. Maybe Matt could make another comment about that, considering his equipment that he's sort of marketing out there.
Definitely. The technology has moved a long way, and in terms of video quality, it's pretty much there. The unit that I'm wearing at the moment is recording at 740 by 480. It can do 30 frames per second. So what that basically means is that you're at the upper end of standard definition. A lot of these cameras are used by all the major networks, 7, 9, 10. If you watch Bondi Rescue, this is what they're using on the boards. They use them in The Biggest Loser, the list goes on. What we're seeing now is high-definition cameras are just starting to appear on the market, very small high-definition cameras. So in terms of video quality, we're pretty much there. What's got to catch up a little bit is battery technology. The battery life is still not so good on these things, but it's getting pretty close. Like I say, the transmission is a bit of an issue because we're talking about pretty big file sizes. Talking about for high def, you're looking at around about a gig per 30 minutes. Now, I mean, storage is there, but if you want to do anything with it, you want to edit it, upload it, share it, then you're starting to have problems. And what you're having to do is compress the footage down to almost an unusable level. So especially in Australia, we've got pretty horrible internet speeds. So that's something that definitely really needs to pick up to make the technology more usable, especially in that sort of sharing realm. But yeah, in terms of video quality, it's pretty much there. It's pretty amazing what you can achieve.
Yeah. So do we have to have quite high-end local capacity to do any sort of decent editing with the videos, if you're looking at a gig?
Again, computer technology is moving along pretty bloody rapidly. So really, you know, anything that's a couple of years old is going to have the ability to edit this high-end video. Even something like, again, like what I'm wearing, you could probably edit on a four-year-old computer, piece of cake, you know, Windows Movie Maker or iMovie will do a perfectly fine job. And those sort of programs are very simple to use. They've come a long way. You know, 5 years ago, if you tried to edit a movie, you needed to have a fairly good knowledge of how to use these programs. It's got to a point now where most people can jump on. You don't even really need the instructions. It's pretty intuitive. You know, drag and drop, cut and chop, chuck a title on there, upload it. It's not that hard.
Terrific. Thanks, Matt. I think we're getting close then by the sounds of it. One of the things that we've not really discussed in detail is the sort of ethical considerations around POV. We've sort of touched on it a few times, but there are probably a number of issues in that area, and I might ask Katina to kind of talk to us about, you know, what are some of the privacy issues, the security issues, those sorts of things that we might need to think about in terms of using this technology, who's being recorded, where it goes, all that sort of thing. So
it's very interesting to hear your perspective, Matt, that the technology is almost there, and I think indeed it is. Point of view has been around. It's not a new concept, or perhaps it's a new term, but it's not a new concept. Steve Mann, for instance, was using point of view technologies in class under instruction as far back as 98, and his documented work on what he calls existential technology and existential education. He's an engineer by profession and was part of the MIT Media Lab. So it's very interesting to hear, of course, the technology. We're actually, I wouldn't say almost there, we're there. We've just seen it demonstrated. In fact, Michael just indicated to us previously in his talk how easy it was just to film something using the glasses and to transfer it onto his laptop and for us to view it on a screen. So the technology is there. The problem is not the technology. The issues are not about the technology. We're only going to get better at doing the technology, of course, as there is development cycles and we get faster and smaller and bigger in terms of storage capacity and the ability to send back real-time information to a server so that we don't have to do that clunky bit like put the USB stick in our computer and have it on the screen. It's just going to be on a server somewhere near us. So this kind of follow-me technology will be here in not too distant in the future. And I think your invention, Matt, is just absolutely wonderful in terms of its capability. What is lagging behind and is often the case in all innovation, and Michael can speak to this also, is the legal background, the legal perspective, and that's something we really haven't discussed. There's not much in the literature, not much research has happened in this area. Regulations. And we all live in different jurisdictions, even different states. So what do your state laws say about you filming someone down a public space? What is a public space? What's a private space? Is your bedroom a private space? If I'm wearing one of these perhaps covert technologies in the future and I'm filming in my bedroom, is that a private space? Is that a public space? Is the change room at the local gym a private space or a public space? And some people have taken point of view to the nth degree. They want to film everything around them. They want to film ongoingly, 24/7. They don't want to press the off switch. And they have the capability to do that. There are these technologies available. There are storage capabilities. And I'll show you one in talk later on. So what does your jurisdiction say about filming others in a public space from the legal side? what does your organisation say about it? When do I have to fill out a human research ethics application? What if one of my students doesn't want to consent to an application which has been approved, but they just don't want to participate? Do you have an alternative task? And what does opting in actually really mean? Opting in to them giving you their data and filming for, you know, the duration of the tutorial class, the duration of the week where the assessment is due, marked, and then you give back the results and then press the delete button, that session, that year, the duration of the candidature, the duration of 7 years in respect to VET, indefinite if you put it on YouTube, and who has the license to press the delete? You as the assessor or the collaborator? Who is it that is driving this development? So I'm very encouraged to see that we are encouraging our students to create. I'm really encouraged. I think that's the way to go. They must create. We are engaging them by creating. So I'm very for this. I just have a lot of unanswered questions, which we're all going to learn together, I think.
What I thought I might do is go round to each of the panel members and let them make a comment, maybe have them share with us an idea about something they've seen or thought about that is a great application or use of POV in vocational education or higher education, just really quickly, and then we might open it up to questions the audience. Are we right? Okay, so we might start with Andrew, seeing as how we started with him before, and he's had a big rest.
Thank you, Vicky. I guess I've got two comments. One on a personal aspect. For some reason, my kids are amazing at music, and I struggle to understand it. My youngest son is seven, going on eight. He's been playing the trumpet for about 6 months. He now takes the POV glasses into music, half an hour lessons every week. He records the session, of course, with the permission of his music teacher. And he can go back now on my phone, on the PC at home, and in his own e-portfolio, and review how he's going. So personally, I think that's absolutely fantastic. We don't share that. He doesn't share that. It's not on YouTube, something I wouldn't like to do. Through work, one of the earliest things we done probably about 6 months ago in running a vocational training company, we have a lot of projects and a lot of training programs in warehousing. And we have a lot of participants coming through that have potentially served time. They have issues with chemical use for use of a word over their lifetime and have really huge issues with language and literacy. And when you get a group of blokes come in like that, and on the first day you throw them a 100-page work cover forklift document and you go, here you go, mate. After 2 days training, you need to know this inside and out, and then we're going to get a work cover accredited bloke come in and assess you to make sure you can drive a forklift. Generally by lunchtime, they're gone. Right? And that's a reality. And, you know, so one of the things we adapted and was really taken upon, we had our trainers, the people who are the expert in the forklifts and the assessors of the forklifts, put the glasses on. Two most critical things are a pre- and post-inspection. Create those videos. They're short bursts of content. Participants are coming in and we're saying, you got Bluetooth on your phone, mate? Just activate it and grab the post and pre-video, because they're the two things that are most important. And it was really positive at the end of it to see people sitting there 2 minutes before they're doing their assessment watching those videos. I think that made a big difference.
I guess, first of all, I'd like to make an ethics comment. And that is, I think, as teachers, you need to be thinking about ethically your duty of care in terms of working with students and being so frightened by the ethical issues that have been mentioned that you push it away and you don't engage. I think, for me, not engaging with students and raising the issues, dealing with them head on, dealing with them in a critical way, and really preparing your students to be active and effective users of new technologies and on the online world, then you're actually doing your students a disservice. So I guess I'd like to say, yeah, there are issues. We need to confront them, but don't let them let that frighten you off.
Absolutely.
For me, my Vicky said I have a background in adult literacy, and for a long time I've been really passionate about digital stories and what they, the way in which they can give a voice to members of the community who can't engage with reading written text in the way that we take for granted. Digital stories have already been mentioned today, and essentially it's a combination of images, voice, short video clips and sound into a short mini movie, typically about 3 minutes in length. And I guess I've been pondering the way that POV might actually bring that into the present, because normally digital stories are very personal narratives about the past and events and personal lives in many cases. So I think there's some really interesting opportunities here to actually capture insights from individuals in the community and our students that are happening to them now in this way. So I guess I'm really interested not so much in the product but in the creative ways that we can use this in terms of capturing experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think Robin mentioned, you know, how might we use this sort of technology in areas like fine arts? And that's quite exciting, I think, to actually use them that more creatively than, practical trade-based applications, which are exciting. But creativity, I think, can come out.
Well, as a former classroom teacher, I just can't imagine how wonderful it would be if you gave a group of 10-year-olds this technology and say, go out and create a digital story or a digital narrative around the theme that we've been working on for the last 2 weeks. I mean, the creativity would be obvious, and the potential for this sort of technology would be very impressive, I think. Keenly passionate about educational research, and those of you who saw my slides of research questions today can probably understand why. I want to get to find out how people think, how people learn, how teachers teach, and one wonderful way of doing that, I would think, is using these sorts of technologies. It's a way of, and Tony mentioned it, of getting a new way into people's thinking and learning. If you like, it's another form of triangulation. As a qualitative researcher, I spend a lot of time interviewing teachers, interviewing students. I spend a lot of time making observations, writing down reflections, etc. But, you know, the technologies that are used are very intrusive. Video cameras are very intrusive. People don't behave naturally when they're being pointed at with a video camera, or a mobile phone for that matter. They don't behave naturally when you've got an iPod sitting in front of them recording the audio. But if I've got my glasses here and I can take one of those little things and just stick it there and just, you know, it's pretty normal, isn't it? You know, let's talk about what you've done today in class. What did you find difficult about X, Y, and Z? They're not going to be intimidated. The technology, I think, won't get in the way. So the potential I see for those of you who want to enrol at the University of Wollongong in a master's degree or a PhD, come and see me, because I think we could do some absolutely stunning things using this technology.
All right. One thing that I don't think we've really discussed today, or I spoke to Jeff briefly about, in terms of education and training of using POV technology, where I think there is huge application is actually in the realm of sports training and education. It's quite interesting to actually put a camera on someone and see, in a sporting context, why did you choose to throw the ball to person A when you could have thrown it to person B? and really analysing how people react to certain situations. And that can sort of be, that sort of use can also come into VET, which is a new acronym for me. I've learnt it about halfway through the day. You know, we can use POV technology to create training tools and procedures and whatnot, but we can also use it to do analysis after someone's done their training or partway through their training and say, you know, put the camera on them, get them to wear it while they're doing their practice of their task, and then do an analysis afterwards and say, well, why did you choose to do this? Why did you go here? Why did you use this tool? Whatever it is. I think that's an application of this technology that will be used a lot.
Excellent, Matt. So it sounds like POV is really part of a whole process of learning, and we can actually use it to enhance, enrich and value add. So, Alison, what are your thoughts?
The light bulb moment for me, and I think Tony gave an example in her presentation, was the automotive person that needs to demonstrate something underneath a car. Now, how do you teach that to a group of students if you don't have the ability to actually show what you're doing? So I think in terms of those situations, it's going to be quite powerful. And I suppose it's about choice as well. A lady who presented at the Australian ePortfolio Symposium, Hazel Owen from New Zealand, talked about how students were able to use video recordings for their reflections. And some of the students said that they probably wouldn't have done the reflection if they were made to write the reflection down, and that how powerful it was to be able to talk it through. So it's about, I suppose, choice for people. And it's interesting, I've never thought about the opt-out situation. It's always trying to encourage them to get in, you know, let's get you in first. I'd be scared if they start opting out.
Do you think they would, Alison? Do you think they'd get quite excited about using the technology and the fun of wearing the glasses, and that would actually overcome some of those...
It depends on who you are. The same as you know with your colleagues. You know, the first thing that happened when Simon was doing that Twideo or whatever it was, where you can take a recording on your mobile phone and then shoot it up, you know, like Michael and I, it's the first thing we try to do is work out how to do it, whereas I know most of my colleagues would have just gone, whoa, that just seems too hard. It's, you know, I don't want to go down that. And I think kids are the same, or younger people are the same. They don't necessarily always embrace, and I think, again, you had some statistics along that just because we think it's... just because we're geeks doesn't mean everybody else is a geek.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we stereotype young people and we think they're all geeks too, but we are getting some feedback where there are age groups where they don't want to really engage with certain technologies, and we need to keep that in mind, that just because they're in the Generation X, Y or YouTube generation, that not all of the kids in those generations are engaging with the technology and love it.
Well, I think I'd like to encourage everyone to visit Steve Mann's homepage called wearcam.org. And Steve Mann is an engineer from the University of Toronto. Not only is he an inventor of about 80 different patents, at least on last count, he's also a novelist, he's an actor, he's a musician, he's developed the hydrolophone. He's one of the most creative people of the 20th century, I'd say, 21st century.
Yes, yes.
And if you want to see the birth of wearable computing from where he came from, which was MIT Media Labs in the mid-80s to mid-90s, visit his homepage, visit wearcam.org, and more importantly, visit one of his latest inventions, which has 48,000 subscribers, which is glogger.mobi. Glogger is spelled glogger.mobi, M-O-B-I. On glogger.mobi, you will see one of the most incredible technologies you can become part of. And let's just say we could talk to after you visited that site. If you want to see point of view 24/7, visit glogger.mobi and look at the storyboard capability on that website. Look at the ability to take 24/7 footage and remotely send it back to a server. very much free, and also the ability to location track. So not only are you taking visual imagery, you are taking a location as well. So you know who the person is, you know where the person is, and you can see them on a global map, all linked via social networking.
Wow. Big brother gone mad. Okay, Tony, your comments. And...
I think that assessment for me is really interesting, and I never ever thought I would ever be a person that would be interested in assessment. But I'm so interested in it because assessment ultimately is what drives our practice, which is so wrong. And I see the potential for point of view technologies as improving that. And I was talking to someone before earlier this morning, and we were just saying, you know, sometimes students can't communicate what they need to communicate to us. Sometimes they don't know how to be critical. And when we're asking them to write it, we try to phrase maybe one sentence to spur them on, to give us the information that we're looking at, when really we could walk up to them and ask them a question. And the ability to be able to have the technology ourselves as educators and wander around classrooms and ask students questions and be very specific about the questions we're asking based on that particular student's work and get a very specific response from them. And I think that that potential to gather that really high level of data and information is huge, because I think students a huge disservice by not giving them a flexible platform to share their learning and their knowledge.
And that skill about being critical, I think, is really key to the digital literacies that our students need to have as well. We might have a couple of minutes for a couple of questions. So does anybody have a question they'd like to ask? We've got a couple of microphones we can bring down to you if you want to ask a question of the panel.
Anyone on the panel, it doesn't matter. I wish I had coined the phrase, but I came across a interesting video on YouTube the other day, or TeacherTube, sorry, called Digital Learners in an Analog School. And it's probably something that's quite appropriate. So I'm just wondering, how is it best to use these technologies to support not only the learners, but also the teachers?
Who would like to answer that?
I do think about that a lot because, you know, we work with teachers to try and get them to use the technology and wire them, picking them up and loving them, and a lot of them not. I think what it is in our sector in any way is that they're not reflective thinkers themselves. In fact, some of them are the worst learners. They want you to take their hand and they want you to step through everything. And to me, that's not a learner. That's a sponge, basically. I think in the vet sector, I probably could talk all afternoon about professional. You know, they're not managed very well. They're sort of expected because they're professionals. And again, I don't want to bag the vet sector as such, but, you know, in the vet sector, you only need a Cert 4, so technically full-time 6 months qualification, and you come out, and if you work for a TAFE in South Australia, you can come out and be paid the same as somebody who does a 3 or 4 year teaching degree. So very intensely about what is education. So the vet sector focuses a lot in on industry. So I think, look, there's a whole sort of door, you know, you've opened up a huge box around professional development. They need to first of all understand that they need to be professionally developed. They don't. They go to work, they do their job, and they go home. They're not professionals.
I've had an actual experience of that yesterday when I actually worked with a group of teachers, and I almost lectured them saying, you are professionals, you're teachers. Professional development isn't something that you can do within your 30 hours a week, and maybe you need to actually think about the fact that you're a professional. And because I run professional development programs, and I say to them, one particular one I do, it's going to take you 3 or 4 hours a week to do this. You can't do it in your 1 hour PD. You have to do it in your own time. And, you know, some of them are really challenged by that, and it's challenging for us, I think. But I think we're kind of getting outside the realm of our discussion, and I think Alex is going to wrap it up soon, so we might just let Robin have a say and then we'll wrap it up.
I think we're all a bit dumbfounded there, because you talked about schools being analogue and then you talked about the teachers. And my immediate thought was, it's not the teachers, it's the bureaucracy and the structure in which they're working in that is hindering things, not the teachers. In terms of teachers, I think you need to find champions, you need to model them, you need to find exemplars, and you need to get them out there, and you need to show teachers real ways of using them and real immediate uses for them. But teachers are struggling because they don't have time, because of the system that they're working in is not allowing them the space and the time. And now I'm out of the framework, I can quite frankly say that we used to have a wonderful program called LearnScope that gave that, and we've taken that away. It actually bought people time to stop and reflect and to learn new things and to engage with peers. And until we find, again, a space where people can do that, and I know that it's an issue for us in higher ed, academics just don't have time. They are frantic in terms of time. So somehow systems have got to buy that time back for their staff if they want them to move forward.
Yeah, so it comes back to almost a resourcing issue, doesn't it? Time, facilities. I also find that getting teachers to use some of the tools for their work, for their team collaboration, just using a wiki space in their teaching section for them to plan and organise things and start using tools that way is really making a difference, giving them a simple tool to start with to get engaged at a basic level. I think we've got to wrap up now, so I'd really like to thank our panel members. I think it's been a stimulating and fantastic discussion about a whole range of issues, not just POV, and POV is really just a technology that sits within a much bigger, broader educational discussion and application. So thank you, everyone, for your participation.
And if I could just ask the panel just to stay for a minute. In wrapping up the session, I'd also like to ask you to put your hands together and thank Vicky for hosting this afternoon's panel.